So I just wanted to show you, so far we've been talking about a really simple system, which is a particle in a box, and we've learned a tremendous amount about quantum mechanics, just looking at that really simple system, and also the little harmonic thing going back and forth, the ball and the bowl. Okay, if we can also extend those ideas to a real system of extreme importance to everyone, and that is atoms. Okay, so the idea of when we have the particle in the box, or the particle bouncing around in that bowl, what we have is these sorts of patterns, right? So there's all these kind of standing waves and all that kind of stuff. So that's in one dimension. Okay, in two dimensions we can also have standing waves. So if we have, say, the round surface of a drum like this, okay, and if we hit the drum, say, right in the center, then what it's going to do is it's going to push down and then oscillate back up. And so the pattern will look something like this, and it will just oscillate up and down. If we can also get, and that's analogous to this kind of mode, which just oscillates up and down, standing wave. Okay, we can also get more interesting modes, like a mode that has a node all the way down the center line of the drum. So if we hit it, say, right at that point over there, then this part of it will go down, and that part of it will go up, and it will just go back and forth like that. Okay, so we can get modes also in two-dimensional space. So particles confined to a two-dimensional space will have a two-dimensional pattern of standing waves, back and forth like that. And also in three dimensions. So if we take a proton like this and stick an electron in its neighborhood like that, and the electron has sufficiently low energy, then that proton can capture that electron, and there's a force of attraction between these guys, and it will keep it bound, okay, to some region of space. Okay? And we can also then have standing waves in three-dimensional space. And so many of you will have seen the pictures of these standing waves. These are called orbitals. And you see them in quantum mechanics. In chemistry. Okay, how many of you have seen orbitals? Pictures of orbitals. Okay, so this is an applet which shows pictures of orbitals. Okay, so this is the lowest energy state. Okay, and that's just what it is a spherically symmetric fuzzy ball, okay, telling you that the probability of finding the electron at any instant of time is maximum near the center of that fuzzy blob, and it decreases as you go outwards. Now you'll notice, if I turn up the simulation speed here, that it also has a phase, okay? So it's also a complex number. So it's like our guy like this, except it's rotating around and around and around, complex phase, going through all the colors. Same thing is happening here. It's this blob in space going through this phase. Okay? But if we kill the phase, if we ask what is the probability of finding the electron anywhere, okay, and we just look at it and just kill the phase, it's just perfectly static. And the same thing would happen if we put it in any other state, like for example this guy over here. Okay, so this is a p orbital, for those of you who know a little bit of chemistry. And so if we look at the wave function, okay, what we see is it's really a complex number at any point. Okay, and that complex number is the angle of that complex number is changing all the time. And we see these this rainbow pattern changing with time. But if we kill if we kill the color and just look at the probability of finding the electron somewhere at any instant of time, it's just static. It's perfectly static like that. So it's saying that if I look at the atom, if the atom was in this state, this p orbital state, then there's a high probability I'd find the electron over there if I looked, or over there, and a low probability I'd find it over there. Okay? And you can see that these are two blobs in space. I can rotate these guys around. You can see it's just two blobs in space, right, like that. And there are lots of higher order codes here, like this guy. Does it show what? I see. So if you have two atoms coming together to form a bond, there may be one of those amplets on here, but I'm not sure. This is just a single atom. Okay, so you can see with this one here, there's a blob over here. If you looked at the electron when the atom is in this state, then there's some probability to find it over here, or in this band. So it looks like a band, but that band, if we rotate it, we see that it's actually a torus. It's actually a donut shape. You can sort of see the donut there. So it's actually this kind of a picture. where you have a blob up here and a blob down here, and you have sort of a donut shape like that. Okay? And so there are lots of other fancy orbitals as we go higher and higher. Okay, so the question is, but the point is that if we have an atom in any one of those orbitals, if the electron is in any one of those orbitals, then the picture looks like this. There are certain allowed energy levels, and we talked about these. This is the ground state at -13.6 electron volts. This is E0. Okay, but then there are also other states, excited states, which are like this. And then they form nearly a continuum at the top there. And then up here, remember, are the states of the electron when they're free of the atom, when they're free of the nucleus of the atom and just floating through space. Okay? So the point is that if we have the electron in any one of these states, say it's in this state over here, then its probability pattern is just static. It just sits there. If you look at the atom at any instant of time, you'll always have the same probability pattern, same probability of finding it at various locations. Okay, nothing is dynamic. Nothing interesting is happening. Okay, it's in a stationary state. So here's our atom, and it's in this state, let's say, like this. Okay? And compare that, say, to the ground state, which is just this spherically symmetric ball, like this. So let's suppose that that's this state over here versus this state down here. So that one's that one, and that one's that one. Okay, so now what we do is we fire a photon at the electron, a photon at the atom when it's in this state over here. Okay, so the photon comes in, and we suppose that the energy of the photon, which is just h times its frequency, is exactly the difference between this guy and this guy. Okay, then what it does is it induces the atom to enter a superposition, to be simultaneously in this state and this state. Okay, and because the complex numbers here are rotating at different frequencies, you're going to get some time-dependent cancellations and time-dependent constructive and destructive interference. Okay, so let's do an example of that. So let's suppose that, let's clear that here, and let's look at the phases of color here, and let's put it in a superposition of being in this state over here and this state. Okay? And you see that there's definitely something dynamic happening now. If we get rid of the color, if we get rid of the phase and just look at the length of those complex numbers, it's still sloshing back and forth. Okay, so physically, and it's sloshing back and forth at a frequency, which is the frequency difference between this guy and this guy. Okay, it's sloshing back and forth at exactly this frequency right here, the frequency of the incoming photon. Okay, so we've got our atom like this, it's in an excited state, and we have this photon come in like this, and it induces this superposition state, and in that superposition state, the atom is radiating, it's creating a photon. And then in the after picture, the energy is now down, say this is E1, the energy is now down to E0, but there's an extra photon, exactly in phase with the original photon. And as I said, you have this laser. Okay, if you shine a photon at this atom that has a frequency or an energy that's not, say it's in this state, that's not either this or this or this or this, then it can't produce a superposition state, and the photon will just pass by the atom, it won't see it. Okay, only if it has this exact energy will the atom see the, or will the photon see the atom and be absorbed and cause this this superposition. Okay, and it works the other way around too. If you're in this ground state, and a photon of, say, this energy goes flying past the atom, then it will induce this superposition, and it will absorb that photon and jump up to that level. Okay, so this is really, really quite beautiful, the nature of an atom, this quantum nature of the atom, how it's actually really creating and absorbing photons. Yeah.
But could you, rotate that around so I can see more spatially what it looks like?
So you can see that if we're looking sort of edge-on, top-down, it's not doing anything. But if you rotate it on its side like this, then you can see that definitely it's sloshing back and forth. And we can put some other states in here. So now it's in a superposition of three different states now, and it's doing some weird stuff.
Oh, I can't start three, so it's just the highest and lowest.
Oh, then it'll be a mix. It'll be a mix of both differences. both differences will be present. So that frequency minus that frequency, that frequency minus that frequency, and that frequency minus that frequency. All three differences, sorry, will be present.
What do you do?
Yeah, but it looks like it's two different frequencies that are rotating, and then there's one light frequency overall that's rotating.
Well, yeah, there's a slow one back and forth.
Yeah.
And then there's a faster one, and there should be a third one in there.
Yeah. The farthest corner through the middle, here, I think. You see it?
Yeah.
The very faint one going through the middle.
Oh, this one here. Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That one.
Yeah. That's the one.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Okay, so so that's it. So basically, one thing I just want you to appreciate is that an atom is really a purely quantum mechanical object. Okay, it exists because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, like it can't exist in Newton's universe. All these atoms here exist for that reason. And quantum mechanics gives us this really, really beautiful picture of this process of emission and absorption of photons. Okay. So you've heard the phrase Schrodinger's equation bandied about every once in a while. So how many of you would like to see a little more detail about Schrodinger's equation and how you actually get Schrodinger's equation and what it means? Do I have a majority?
Yeah.
Okay, I got a majority. Okay, so this, I have to warn you, this will involve a little bit of mathematics. And it will involve taking derivatives. Okay, it'll involve complex waves and taking derivatives. But even if you don't understand the details of all of that stuff, if you can get at least the gist of the idea, that'll be great. Okay, so let's see if we can do this. So I wrote down a complex wave. So when we say, okay, a particle is moving to the right with some momentum plus p, how is that described quantum mechanically? Well, it has a real part and an imaginary part. So this is the real axis, this is the imaginary axis, and its its cosine in the real, then its sine in the imaginary, et cetera, et cetera. And the wave is actually a complex exponential. That looks like that. Okay? And where this is the physical momentum of the particle, that's the physical energy, and that's Planck's constant. Okay, so this describes this complex wave pattern, that spiral wave. As time goes on, that pattern moves to the right. Okay, so now the idea is that that wave is going to satisfy some kind of an equation, a wave equation. How many of you have ever seen any kind of a wave equation? Okay, so just about a quarter of you have seen a wave equation. Okay, so a wave equation is something that involves figuring out how something changes with time, as well as how quickly something changes with time, and how quickly it changes over distance. So it involves derivatives. Okay, so a wave equation, Schrodinger's wave equation, is going to involve taking derivatives of this function, of this wave. Okay, so let me just remind you about how to differentiate an exponential. Okay, so if you have e to the x, so Stefan talked a little bit about this at the beginning. If I take the derivative of that thing, let me use this notation. It'll be better later on. So if I have e to the x, and I differentiate that with respect to x, well, let's start with a simpler example. So Stefan told you this one, right? If I differentiate x to the n, what do I get? Nx to the n minus 1. Okay, if I differentiate, say, e to the x, what do I get?
E to the x.
If I differentiate, say, sine x,
cosine.
I get cosine. If I differentiate cosine x,
minus.
Negative sine. Okay, so we know how to differentiate things, okay, simple functions like this. Okay, now, what if I take, instead of the derivative with respect to x of e to the x, suppose I take d by dx of e to the some number alpha. So alpha is just some number. It could be 5 or 7 or negative 2, or it could be even complex. What is the derivative of this with respect to x?
Alpha
e to the alpha x. Okay, one easy way to see this is I could multiply and divide by alpha both sides of this. Okay? And this alpha I could bring here. So I'm differentiating not with respect to x, but with respect to alpha x. Okay, so now this looks like alpha times d by d some other variable y e to the y. We already know that the derivative of e to the y with respect to y is just e to the y. And then we have this extra constant alpha up front. Okay, and then y, we said, was equal to alpha times x. Okay? I don't want you to, if you don't understand that, it's not a big deal. Okay, all I want you to see is that if I put a derivative in front of, so let me just write it down up here. Okay, so even if you don't understand where that comes from, that's just a rule to just keep in mind. Okay? So now what we're going to do is we're going to take derivatives of that complex wave up there, which has disappeared from view. Okay, can you sort it off? Okay, so let's put that over here. And let's move over here. Okay, so what if I take the derivative with respect to time of psi? What am I going to get? So this is my wave psi. And I take the derivative of this with respect to time. Is it obvious what I'm going to get? Yeah.
Question. Because they are, there's time and position, shouldn't you instead use the d, the little curly thing for partial derivative?
Yeah, that's right. So this d should actually be partial derivative. Actually, here it's fine, but here it should be partial derivatives. Okay? But I don't want to confuse everyone, so let's just use just this. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so we're differentiating with respect to t, holding x constant. Okay, so does someone have some sense of what that might be? Okay, let's start with differentiating with respect to x. Someone have a sense of what that might be? Yeah.
All right, so I p over h bar times to that jump.
Yes. So one way to maybe simplify this is I know that e to the a times e to the b is what? Okay, so what I have here is e to the sum of two terms, here, well, actually a difference. Okay, I can write that as a product. I can write that as e to the I over h bar px times e to the minus I over h bar dt. Okay, so when I differentiate this thing with respect to x, it means hold t constant. So this is just a constant. Okay, so now I'm just differentiating this guy and multiplying by that constant. And what do I get? This whole thing can be thought of as just some constant alpha. So I have an e to the alpha x. I differentiate with respect to x. I pull down that alpha. So what I get is just I just get I over h bar p. I just pull that alpha down times the original function. Okay? Are you okay with that? I realize that this is a bit of a stretch here, okay? But I just want you to see that Schrodinger's equation is actually very, very simple. The concept behind it is very, very simple and natural. Okay, so suppose we're okay with that, which we're not quite, but let's just move on here so that we can do some other stuff. But this is really cool. I think this is a very important idea. What if I differentiate again? Okay, so what does that mean? That means take the derivative with respect to x of the derivative with respect to x of psi. We already know what the derivative of psi is with respect to x. It's this thing. Okay, so it means take the derivative again of that same thing. What am I going to get? I'm going to get what?
I over h bar times
So I'm going to get I over h bar p, that's just a constant out front, times the derivative of psi with respect to x. But we already know what that is. That's I over h bar p times psi. So I get that thing squared times psi. What is that equal to? What happens to the I squared? So it becomes negative p squared over h bar squared times psi. What if I take the derivative of psi with respect to t, holding x constant? So now I go back to this thing and I say, OK, I don't care about x. This is just a constant. I'm differentiating this thing with respect to that variable. So it's e to the some number t. I'm differentiating with respect to t. What am I going to get? Right, I'm going to get minus I over h bar times e times the original function. Okay? So, now let's do just a tiny bit of algebra, and we will get Schrodinger's equation. Okay, and so what we will do is we will say, let's consider minus IH bar times d by dt of psi. What is that equal to? We know what this is. It's right there. What if I multiply by minus IH bar? What do I get?
The
h goes, squared the I. Squared cancel out, negative cancels out, and the I squared becomes negative 1 plus negative e sub. Oh, I see. Oh, I'm sorry, I wanted to
Yeah.
Okay, so we have that. Let's consider also negative h bar squared over 2m times the second derivative of psi with respect to x. So we already know what that second derivative is. What if we multiply by negative h bar squared over 2m? What do we get? Okay. In Newtonian mechanics, energy is kinetic energy plus potential energy.
Why are we just multiplying by IH and H squared over 2m? Like, where are those coming from?
Why are we doing that? Okay, you'll see presently. So energy in the Newtonian universe is just kinetic plus potential. Okay. In this case, we're dealing with a free particle. We're dealing with a particle just moving along the x-axis without encountering any forces or anything. So there's no potential. That's just zero. The energy is kinetic. How do I express the kinetic energy in terms of the momentum? Okay. So for the situation we're describing, E is just p squared over 2m. So this is just equal to that. So E is p squared over 2m. So E times psi is the same as p squared over 2m times psi, no matter what psi is. Okay. So this equals this. You see that? Okay, that means this equals this. Okay, so that's Schrodinger's equation. It says that IH bar times the time derivative of my wave function is minus h bar squared over 2m times the second derivative with respect to the spatial coordinate, with respect to x of psi. And if there's a non-zero potential energy here, just say a function of x or something, like we have when the ball is rolling around in the bowl like this, there's a potential energy which is proportional to x squared. Okay, then we just add this v. It just becomes v times psi. And this is Schrodinger's equation. Okay, so any particle in any situation, in any potential energy situation, satisfies that equation. And we just verified that for a free particle, but you can also verify that for the particle bound to the box. It also satisfies, it also works for, of course, these guys here. So these guys here, if you look at any one of these, say this guy, right? This guy over here, that's some wave. That's some function of x, y, z, and time. So at any instant of time, t, it's some complex number at every point in space. It's a function like this. And if I were to plug that function into this equation, if I add also d squared, dy squared, t squared, dz squared, it will satisfy, that wave will satisfy that equation.
Why did you put the potential energy equal to zero?
The potential energy was zero in our example because we just had a free particle. So it wasn't bound by any forces or anything. So there's no, it's not in a potential energy of any kind. So that's it. So that's essentially a physical intuition into Schrodinger's equation. And notice that Schrodinger's equation is based on the idea that energy is just p squared over 2m. In reality, we know that this is true. In a relativistic universe, if we take into account that the universe has a speed limit, then the relationship between energy and momentum is a little bit more complicated. It looks like this. Okay? And one of the exercises at the very beginning of this camp, you were asked to show, that this equation here reduces to this equation. So if you take the square root of both sides, and treat C as very, very large, then it becomes energy is approximately p squared over 2m plus mc squared. Okay, so this is saying that when the particle is at rest, the energy is just mc squared, just the rest energy. And when it's in motion with some non-zero momentum, you add to that energy some kinetic energy. Okay. But the real relationship between momentum and energy is this relationship here. Okay. So basically, Schrodinger's equation is based on non-relativistic Newtonian mechanics. Okay. And then people like Klein-Gordon and Dirac try to write a similar kind of equation, wave equation, based upon this formula. And when you do that, you find a remarkable thing happens. Let me just say what it is, and then we'll quit because we don't want to spend all day on this. Okay, so what happens is really remarkable. You'll notice that this energy, this is squared, right? So when you take the square root, there's two possible signs. Okay, and those two possible signs are intimately connected with. Let me just say what it is. If you take the square root of this and you work it out, et cetera, it's a complicated thing. You find that sign. Let me just give you a little bit of progression here. We started out thinking of the wave function as real waves, cosine and sine. We just discovered that doesn't work. We have to extend to complex numbers. Okay, so psi goes from a real number to a real number plus I, like has a real and imaginary part. Okay, so it has two parts. Okay, and then it turns out that in order to satisfy this equation, combining quantum ideas with relativity ideas and taking the square root here, it turns out that the kind of object that you have to deal with is not just a complex number, but four complex numbers. So psi becomes four complex numbers, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and psi 4. Okay? So you have to expand. So we used to expand it from just real to complex. And then you make another expansion to four complex numbers at any point in space and time. Okay? And these two are associated with spin. Yeah. Yep. These are associated with spin. This is the probability of finding an electron at some location spin up. This is the probability amplitude of finding the electron at that same location but spin down. There's two numbers, spin up and spin down. Probabilities for spin up and spin down. Okay? And what do you think these are? Antimatter, that's right. Okay, so this is matter, and this is antimatter. Okay, so in trying to combine quantum with relativity, Dirac was the guy who did this. Dirac discovered that you needed four complex numbers, and he tried to make heads or tails of this, and he interpreted this as spin, these two as spin, but matter and antimatter. So a natural prediction, so spin and antimatter, they're natural consequences. They're intimately connected with this special relativistic universe that Einstein had discovered. Okay, so, enough said on that. Okay, so is that cool? Yeah.
That's from special relativity, right?
Yeah.
So they actually don't have anything in general relativity yet.
So that's the idea now, is to combine. So if, I mean, this is the remarkable thing. If you combine quantum ideas with just special relativity, all kinds of things happen,
right,
including spin and antimatter.
Is that the standard model?
Yeah, and this mathematics led to the standard model. So basically, all of the quarks, so the quarks and the leptons are described by these objects. Okay, so actually you can split this in two here and have two component spinners like this. So this describes basically the electrons and the quarks, the leptons and the quarks. And the electron is an example of a lepton. That's right, yeah. Yeah.
What's the last term on that equation?
It's plus V times psi.
What's V stand for?
That's the potential energy. So in our example with the ball rolling back and forth in the bowl like this, V is the shape of the bowl, proportional to the shape of the bowl. We said that the potential energy for this guy rolling around in the bowl is 1/2 kx squared, right? So that's that function of x, yeah.
Is that four vector, is it like constant in all directions?
So this is not a vector. It's not a four vector. It sure looks like a four vector, because it has four components, but it's not. Okay, so this is called the Dirac spinner.
But SU2, if you have two SU2s, it's
individually, this is SU2.
Isn't that isomorphic to the Lorentz spin?
SU2 cross SU2.
Yeah, that's isomorphic.
So this whole thing transforms a certain way under rotations and boosts, which means changing from a frame where you're at rest to a frame in which you're moving.
Shouldn't that mean it's constant in all reference frames?
It's not constant. Like, it transforms a certain way. So in the same way that if I have a vector like this, it has certain components. This is maybe three, say four, and this is six or something. And if I change my coordinate system to that and that, those numbers can change. So the way those numbers change when I rotate the coordinate system determines what kind of objects you're dealing with. Okay, so for vectors, they transform a certain way. This guy, this Dirac spinner, they transform a different way, a special way. Yeah.
Back to that big Schrodinger equation there.
Yeah.
Would you work with the three dimensions, x, y, z? Would you change that d squared over dx squared to that, because I've seen it before, would you change it to that little triangle thing? I don't know what it's called, but.
So you would change, if you wanted to go to three dimensions, you would change. D squared dx squared would become d squared dx squared plus d squared dy squared. Okay, and that's complicated to write down all the time, so people abbreviate that as that. So this is called NABLA. So NABLA squared, yeah.
Well, like back on the other thing with the four different components of that matrix. So is that implying that like you have to have both existing at the same time at all times?
No. So it just says that that if there is such a thing as an electron, okay, that electron is described by some kind of field like this. So if electrons exist in nature, then so do anti-electrons. And then the probability, so you could have a situation where these numbers are non-zero, but all these numbers are zero. In which case, you're dealing with a situation where there are a bunch of electrons present, but no anti-electrons, no antimatter. Or the reverse. Generally speaking, when you have any kind of an interaction, both are present. Yeah. But they need not be in any given situation. OK, so right. So what I wanted to show you now was I wanted to, something more demo-ish, OK? Yeah. So,
demo-ish.
OK, so this is, I'm going to show you this thing. OK, so this thing is, well, it's a tube. OK, it's like this vacuum tube, this glass with vacuum inside. OK, and at the back of the tube is an electron gun. Okay, so a source of electrons.
Yeah.
Basically, electrons are created, and then they are accelerated through a large potential difference. They're placed in an electric field. That electric field exerts a force and accelerates those electrons. So those electrons come from the back of the tube, moving really, really fast, and they fly through something, and then they hit the front of the tube. And so there's this white phosphor on the front of the tube. And what do you think happens when the electron slams into that phosphor? It glows. Okay, so it excites the atoms in the phosphor, so the atoms start in a ground state like this, and they jump up to an excited state up here, and then they will go down to a lower energy level, and in the process they will emit a photon, a green photon. Okay, what I wanted to say there is that. There is no such thing as spontaneous emission in nature. Okay, so sometimes you are told that when an atom, or usually you are told that when an atom is in an excited state like this, then it just spontaneously drops down to a lower energy level, and in the process emits a photon of that energy. Okay, that doesn't happen spontaneously. So in the real world, if an electron were in an excited state like that, okay, all other things being equal, like having said only what we've said so far, that electron would be happy to stay there forever. It would just sit there forever. It would have no reason to jump down to a lower state, drop down to a lower state spontaneously. What actually happens is much more marvelous than that. What happens is everywhere in space, remember this Casimir effect that I talked about? Okay, so between the two plates, between these two metal plates, there are there's continuously photon pairs being created and then annihilated. So there's all kinds of zero-point motion of the electromagnetic field, zero-point fluctuations of the field. Okay. So if I have any atom here, and it's in, say, an excited state, so it's in some weird kind of orbital like this, then in the neighborhood of this atom, there exists naturally, because the vacuum is having the electromagnetic field has these quantum fluctuations, there will be present virtually all photons. Photons of all wavelengths are present, virtual photons. And those virtual photons, one of them will have the right frequency, so that its energy is exactly that energy difference, and will stimulate that emission. Okay, but anyways, that's the side point. Okay, so anyways, there we go. So. So I'm going to turn this thing on, and what you're going to see on that screen is, so it's kind of like a TV screen, right? Like an older TV, like a cathode ray tube kind of TV screen. And what I claim that what you're going to see on that TV screen is more fantastic and marvelous than anything you have ever seen on TV.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's turn this thing on. So first of all, we're accelerating the electron through a large potential difference, okay, a strong electric field. And so I see here, so I have this voltage dial here. This is great. It goes like, in thousands of volts. Okay, so don't come up here and put your tongue on this thing. Okay, so I'll turn this thing on. And actually, I'll turn the lights out. Okay, so. So you see the little green dot?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're up to like 500 volts. Okay. We're up to 1,000 volts now. Okay. 1,500 volts. 2,000. 3,000 volts. Okay, so we're around 4,000 volts. Okay. So what do you see on that screen? Green, it's green, yes, it's green. Okay, what else? Can you tell me any detail? Rings, there are rings there, yes. So it's not just uniform green, there are rings there. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's try to understand why there are green rings there. Okay. All right. So I want to just show you this little PowerPoint quickly here, which talks a little bit about what is happening on that screen. Okay. Hello. Wake up. Okay. So what's inside the tube? Okay, so first of all, you see that there's this screen at the front, this phosphor screen, okay? And at the back of the tube, we have this electron gun, source of electrons. And between the back of the tube and the front, there's a bunch of atoms here. Okay, there's actually about 10 to the 23 atoms there. But since 10 to the 23 is too many atoms to draw, at least on a PowerPoint presentation, we're going to stick with 4. Okay? And so what happens is that electron gun sends out electrons. Okay? And it sends them out basically in random directions. Okay, so the first electron starts over here, flies through space, hits that atom over there at some angle, bounces off, hits the screen over there, and there's a little green flash. Okay? And then the next electron comes along. And it maybe hits not that atom, maybe it hits that atom over there at some angle, so it bounces on the screen and hits over there. Okay, so it's random directions, hitting electrons at random angles, and so what would we expect to see? Okay, oh, let me just actually go down to one atom here, because dealing with a whole bunch of atoms is more complicated. So one of the things that we do in physics, of course, is just simplify as much as possible. Okay, so let's just go through the same thing here. So the first electron comes in, hits the atom at some random angle, bounces off. Okay, the second one comes in, hits the atom at some other random angle, hits the screen, goes off to the screen. Maybe the third one comes, and it just completely misses the first atom. It just completely misses that atom. In fact, most of the electrons coming out of here would just miss that atom. Every once in a while, one would hit the atom and bounce off in some random direction and hit the screen. Okay? So the question is, okay, what would we expect to see on the screen? What kind of a pattern would we expect to see?
Classically.
Just from what we've said so far, yeah.
Little marks here and there.
Okay, so marks here and here. Okay, but now we're gonna hit it with many, many electrons. Okay, so there's a million electrons per second coming through here. So there's a million electrons per second hitting that screen. A scatter pattern. So we see what? So it hits anywhere, right? Okay, so basically, because the electron can come out in any direction, and it can hit this thing at any angle, and it can then scatter off at any angle, what we expect to see is just a uniform distribution of green. Okay, so no pattern of hits. Okay, so let's bring in a second atom, because we know we got more than one atom in there. Okay, so we'll bring in a second atom here, and we'll run through the same sort of idea. Okay, so the electron comes flying out like that, and suppose it's going in a direction so that it hits the first atom, and it bounces off, say, in that direction and hits the screen over there. Okay, then the second electron comes flying out, maybe it hits the second atom at some angle, so it bounces up over there. Okay, and the third one, and so on and so forth. Okay, so these electrons are coming out in random directions, and they're hitting these two atoms at random angles. And so, you know, what do we expect to see on the screen?
Same thing.
So just like a completely uniform distribution of green. Okay. So what we actually see is what we see on the screen right now. There's a pattern of hits. Okay, there's rings. So there are places on the screen where electrons tend to hit and places where they don't hit. Okay? So the pattern of hits looks something like this. So where it's green here, that indicates places on the screen where the electron is likely to hit, and the red axes are places that are dark in between those bright bands, those bright rings. Okay, so how is this possible? Okay, so so let's just review what's going on here. Okay, so what we've got is if we just had one atom here, okay, there's no reason why one of those electrons coming flying out here in some random direction, there's no reason why one of those electrons couldn't come in exactly the right direction so that it reflects the right angle to hit the screen at that location, right? There's no reason why, right? Okay, and if we have just the other atom, okay, that we just get rid of the first one and just stick the second one in, okay, again, there's no reason why an electron couldn't come flying out like this, hit that one atom at the right location and bounce off and hit that spot on the screen. Okay. So if we have both atoms there present, you know, there's basically no reason why we couldn't have, you know, either that happening, you know, or that or the other happening, bouncing off the other. So the point here is something like this. So without this atom here, there's no reason why that electron starting over there can't hit this atom over here and bounce off and hit that red spot over there, or that red X on the screen. Okay? But now suddenly, when we put the second atom in there, we find that it can't hit that spot on the screen. So how is that possible? How is it possible that I bring this second atom in here and it somehow influences this first electron trajectory? Like, if the electron hits this atom here, how does it, and it goes off to the screen, how does it even know that the second atom is there? Right? I mean, if this is the situation, how could this guy know whether that guy's there or not? I mean, it's crazy. Right? And similarly for the other one. Right? There's no reason why the electron couldn't take this path, hit this atom, bounce off, and hit that point on the screen. Okay? And yet it doesn't do that. With the second one present, it doesn't do that. Okay? So somehow it knows about the existence of the other atom. Okay? And the only way it can really know about that is if somehow it exists in both paths. So you can see that this is really just a double slit experiment in disguise here. Okay? So one of the clues for all of this is if you look at the path difference of an electron, say, going here to there and here to there, if you look at the path difference, the points on this screen where it hits and where it doesn't hit depends upon that path difference. Okay, so let's look at, say, an electron, say, going from here to there. It has two possible paths. It can hit, it can scatter off of that atom and go along that path, or it can scatter off the second atom and go along that path. Okay, and there's a difference in path length between those two possibilities. Okay? And if we go to different, if we move our observation point to different points along this screen, we will notice that the path difference between the two possible paths changes in a regular sort of way, okay? In a way that's nicely correlated with the bright and dark spots on that screen. Okay? So basically, the only way to say that the electron somehow knows about the presence of the other atom means that somehow it also knows about the path difference. The only way it could know about that path difference is if somehow it experiences both atoms, it experiences both paths and sees both atoms. Okay, so this gets to this point of, in the double slit experiment, the idea that the electron can exist simultaneously in both the upper path and the lower path in getting from the source to the screen. Okay? Okay, so in the everyday world we have this either or, right? And getting from there to there, the electron can either do that or it can do that. But in the quantum world, of course, it can do both. Okay, so there's this sense in which both of these, in which the electron, in getting from there to there, at some point in time along the way, exists simultaneously over there and over there. Okay? So we already sort of know that, okay? And another way to interpret that is that the universe splits into two. We have this, multiple universes kind of interpretation of quantum mechanics. where in one universe the electron, you know, when faced with a decision, in one universe, one, you know, the electron takes that path, in the other universe, the electron takes the other path. Yeah.
For the Copenhagen interpretation, couldn't we kind of verify, or at least try and verify that, maybe by, like, I'm not sure if it's possible, putting a tracer, like, we couldn't do that on an electron, but on an atom.
Yeah. So what you want to do is find some way to determine which path.
Well, is that what you want? Like, in this case, put something so that if it did bounce off the second atom, it would have something different about itself.
What would be the purpose of doing that?
Well, then you could see if it hit the second atom.
Right.
And then if you do that on, if you had three atoms and you put it on two, and you did it enough times, and if it ever came out without a tracer, then you would know that it didn't take either of those.
That's right. Okay, so the ultimate, the reason for your game here is to try to, we send one electron, we turn the source on over here, and then it hits the screen over there, and we would like to determine which path it took, right, by some way, by putting a tracer on here or on there or the electron or something like that. Okay, so yeah, so let's try to do that. Okay, so let's put a tracer on. Okay, so how can we put a tracer on? Okay, actually, let me just zip ahead here. Okay, so if we put all the atoms back in, all 10 to the 23 atoms back in, okay, the statement, just before we get on to your question there, is that in getting from there to any of those locations on the screen, the electron exists simultaneously in all possible paths. Okay? And the claim is that it does that, it exists in all possible paths, it has this weird sort of superposition of all possibilities if you're not looking. But if you look to determine which path it's going on, then it doesn't. Then it just takes one path. Okay. So how can we look? Okay. Well, one way that we could look is we could remember that an electron has spin. Okay. It's like this little spinning top. Okay. And we can think of the electron then as this kind of a thing. Okay. So the electron comes flying out like this, and it's this little spinning top. Spinning in one direction. And we'll think of it like a billiard ball. So this is a cue ball with a spin on it, and these are other balls which we start out. We start all of them out with no spin. Okay, so we put them all in a state where they're not spinning, and then we click on our source, and we let one electron fly out with spin like this. We let it bounce off of one of these atoms and hit the screen. Okay, and then we go through, and then when that electron hits one of those atoms, the atom that it hits, it will transfer some of its spin, or may transfer some of its spin to that atom. Okay, so just like a spinning cue ball can transfer some of its spin to another billiard ball, right? And so we run the experiment, let one electron go through, hit the screen, and then we get out a really, really big magnifying glass, and we look at every single one of those 10 to the 23 atoms inside this scattering thing, and we try to find which one's spinning at the end of the day. Okay, so you can imagine this is like a real needle in the haystack kind of activity, right? But the fact that it is possible to do in principle has a huge effect. Okay, nature doesn't care whether something's hard to do or easy. The fact is it is possible in principle to go in there after the fact and determine by looking at the spin of these atoms to determine which path it took. So if that's the case, what do you think happens to this pattern here now? That is what?
Loses its effect.
So the entire interference pattern disappears. It's just a total wash. Well, it just becomes completely uniform. Well, isn't that freaky?
Well, couldn't we claim that, like, because when we had spin on things, we couldn't use the spin to determine its path, right? But on the same note, when we had spin, we also had to change variables that whatever was mounted on had spin. So couldn't we also interpret this the same way and say the spin of the things it's mounting off of has an effect on the interference pattern?
Because
otherwise it kind of seems to me just like invisible boy saying, I'm invisible when no one's looking. Right.
Yeah, okay, but we've made it visible though here.
Yeah,
right?
So we can send back to invisible.
Okay, so you're saying, but it's a combination. It's the fact that these can be spinning, and that this is spinning. You need both of them in order for this to be visible. if these could not spin, or that was not spinning, this would not be a way of measuring or determining which path.
I know, but if those are spinning,
yeah.
Right? You can't use them to measure the path, right?
Oh, no. But if so, okay, well, I see what you're saying. But suppose they're all spinning with the same amount of spin. Then the electron comes along and gives this one extra spin, or it stops it from spinning, depending on how it hits it. So it will change the spin. Or you could say you could make this one spin with a spin 1. This is 5, this is a negative 2, this is 7. As long as you record in advance the spins of all those particles, and then this thing comes through, and one of them will have changed its spin value.
But then no matter what, like that thing that the act of recording the spin of the thing that's bouncing off of changes the interference pattern. So does that actually happen?
But you're checking for the spins after the fact.
But
right? Yeah. So the experiment has happened. The electron has popped out here and hit the screen.
But they do spin on their own, right? If we don't do anything?
Yeah, that's right. They spin on their own if
you
don't do
anything. So like right here in the electron gun, the atoms are spinning, right?
Yep.
So if we had...
Well, yes and no. Okay. Yep.
If we had recorded if they were spinning or not beforehand, does that mean that that would be showing the dot now?
Okay. So the at issue here is whether or not this is actually happening in here. And obviously it's not. And so it is true that the electrons in these atoms are in fact spinning, and the electron here, this electron, has spin. Okay, but the nature of the interaction is such that it's a weak enough interaction that you don't actually transfer spin. Okay, so if we had used different materials, different chemical elements, and so on and so forth, and set things up differently so that you could actually have this transfer spin happening, then you would have a wash.
But
in this particular apparatus, this doesn't happen. The electron doesn't transfer spin.
So absolutely nothing in that system is any different if that electron were to hit any particular atom.
That's right. And another way to say it is, suppose that there's a small fraction of atoms that actually do change their spin, but most of them don't. Then, of all the electrons that pass through here, that bounce off of those atoms and don't change a spin, all of those electrons would add up here to produce an interference pattern like that. Okay, but then the few electrons which are actually maybe energetic enough or happen to hit into exactly the right way that they do transfer a spin, those ones that bounce off would make a pattern that's totally random. So you'd have a mix of a totally random. You have a mix of this guy with a little bit of total random.
Okay, well, could you say that's what we had?
Yeah.
Couldn't we say that?
But I'm saying that the fact that it's not like super sharp is due to a different reason. It's due to the fact that the setup inside is not actually as simple as that. The setup inside, it's not just one layer of atoms like that. Of course, it's like actually zillions of atoms. And you're passing through zillions of atoms in a crystal kind of shape. So it's not as clean.
Can we say that the conditions that make it impossible to read the information, like to interpret which way it is, are the same conditions that cause the interference pattern for some others, rather than saying that it takes all the paths? We just can't measure it.
But it's sort of like what you observe depends. You're just saying, I mean, what you observe depends upon the entire apparatus. The physical nature of the entire apparatus. So everything is involved to determine that pattern in any experiment that you do. Okay, so what else did I want to tell you a little bit about? Okay, let me tell you a little bit about entanglement. Okay, so this is something that that you've also heard a little bit about. We heard a little bit about that at the Institute for Quantum Computing when we visited there. We had entangled photons and all that kind of stuff. And we heard that, you know, entangled photons are involved in certain quantum cryptography protocols, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what is it? What is this entanglement idea? Okay, so I want to go through a little bit, just a really, really short PowerPoint here, which talks a little bit about entanglement. Okay, so right. So this is our magic dragon here. Okay, I know it's not a great photo of this dragon. Okay, but if you've got this dragon, I like about it is he's tossing this coin. Okay, and he's a dragon, so he's like magic, right? Okay, so we got our magic dragon, and our magic dragon is At first, our magic dragon is sort of not so magical, and he's just flipping an ordinary coin. Okay? Later on, he'll be doing some quantum magic. Okay, so he flips this coin, and it's just an ordinary coin with heads tails. And what he does is he cuts the coin along its he cuts the coin in half so that so you get two faces. Okay, so here's your coin. Okay, and here's the head's half, and here's the tail's half, and he cuts it along here. Okay, and he splits it in two, so there's two halves. Okay, and he does this without looking at it. Okay, so he flips it like this with his eyes closed. He catches it like this. He takes out his super saw, and he cuts it in half like this without looking. And he puts the two halves in two sealed boxes. Okay, so he puts one half in this sealed box and gives it to Alice. Okay. And then Alice goes off to Venus or something like that. And then and he puts the other half in his sealed box, and he gives it to Bob. And Bob goes off to Mars. Okay. And so neither the dragon nor Alice nor Bob knows what's inside those two boxes. And those boxes are sealed. And so when Alice is on Venus, she opens up the box, and she looks inside. And she finds, heads. Okay. So if that's the case, what's Bob going to see? Tails. Okay. There's 100% chance that Bob's going to look in that box and see tails. Okay. So that's that. Or the other possibility is Alice could open the box and she could find in there tails. Tails half. Okay. And then Bob, of course, would find head. So nothing is odd about this. Nothing is unusual. Okay, and so we're just seeing the fact that in this simple setup, in this simple experiment, there are two possibilities in nature. One is you've split the coin so you've got head there and tail there, and the other possibility is the other one, tails or heads. Okay, and basically this situation of this possibility or this possibility existed right from the time that the dragon flipped the coin and cut it in half, right? While the two halves of the coins were right there, and he put them in the boxes. And then Alice and Bob are traveling to Venus and Mars, respectively. And while they're traveling, what's inside those boxes are definitely a head or a tail, or a tail and a head in the other box, okay, while they're traveling. Okay, so that's simple. Okay, so now, yeah. You're going to miss the quantum part. Okay, so now in the quantum world, we can replace this or with what?
An and.
Okay? So now we have this situation. Okay? So what we've done is we've got our magic dragon here. And instead of having like a coin, what we have is basically, for example, two particles. Okay? And it's such that these particles are let's say two electrons, okay, and these electrons can be put into a state in which they are like this. So we talked a bit about the spin of the electron. So the electron is this, it's sort of like this spinning bar magnet, north-south kind of thing like this. Okay, and so here it's spinning up, and if it's the other way around, say the north down here and the south up there, then it's spinning down. Okay, so there are two possible states, up, down. So it's possible to put nature in, to put a pair of electrons, it's very easy to put a pair of electrons in a state in which, say, the left one is spin up and the right one is spin down. Okay, and it's equally easy to put them in a state where it's the reverse. Okay, so you can have this situation or this situation. And then it's easy to create a state in which both of these are happening simultaneously. Okay, so we have this and in between. Okay. And the flipping of the coin, the randomness, is also built into this. Okay, so basically, our magic dragon flips this magic coin here, and without looking at it, okay, he separates those two halves, puts them into these boxes, and we have this situation now. Okay, these two possibilities. So the question is, what's inside that box? As Alice goes to Venus and Bob goes to Mars, and they're carrying these boxes, while Alice is carrying that box, and while she's on Venus before she looks in the box, what's in the box?
Both.
Both. Sort of. Okay? Okay, so what's in the box is, well, it's in an indefinite state. I mean, for one thing, it's not definitely heads, right? It's not that she's got this heads in that box, and as she goes over there, that head is in that box, and when she lands on Venus, that head is in that box. It's still, it's not like that. Okay, it's this weird state in which it's neither definitely a head nor definitely a tail. It's an indeterminate state like this. And similarly for Bob, okay, these are indeterminate states, indeterminate state of reality. Yeah.
So they're in like superposition of heads and tails, right?
Not individually in either side. It's this situation superimposed with this situation. So you can't say that Alice has inside her box something that is a superposition of heads and tails. It's a superposition of this possibility and this possibility. You can't even describe what's inside Alice's box without reference to what's inside Bob's box. So the odd thing is, we know that because Rob Speckens told us yesterday an experiment where 75%, 85%, how are photons able to do it 85% of the time? That's evidence that this sort of thing is happening. Okay. So normally in study of physics, in study of nature, when we look at something, what we say is, okay, we isolate a system and we say, I want to look at what's inside this room, happening inside this room. So people are playing tennis, there are balls flying around, et cetera, things are happening inside this room. And I can describe what's happening inside this room. There goes a ball flying up there, et cetera, et cetera. We're used to the idea that we can put something inside a box and talk about what's inside that box, right? Totally ignoring everything else in the universe. Okay, what this is saying is, well, you can't really do that. In this situation, even to describe what's inside Alice's box requires that you also talk about what's in Bob's box. You can't separate them. These two things behave in some way as a single entity, separated by a vast distance, but nevertheless as a single entity. You can't isolate this and say what's inside that box. All you can say is, this and this is happening at the same time, okay? And that's spread out over large space, big space, okay? Right. Okay, so now what happens? Let's see. Okay, so Alice now opens the box and looks inside. Okay, to look inside, what does that mean? Well, that means basically shine a photon on the electron that's inside her box. And see whether it, you know, changes spin or whatever. There's simple ways in which she can measure the spin. Okay. Well, basically what she does is she puts it through one of those Stern-Gerlach apparatuses. And if it goes in the upper beam, then it's spin up. If it goes in the lower beam, it's spin down. But in that process, she forces nature basically to choose one or the other alternative. She forces nature to choose, not heads or tails here, she forces nature to choose between this and this. It's very important. What she does over here, locally in her box, affects the entire thing, this entire distributed system. It affects also what happens in Bob's box. Okay, that's the important point. Okay, so she looks inside and she forces nature to choose one of those alternatives. Okay, and it goes back to this either-or thing. And so nature will choose one or the other purely randomly. Okay, and so maybe nature chooses this option. Okay. Now, this is the interesting thing, is that the instant this changes from an indefinite state to a definite state, it becomes definitely heads, say, at that exact same instant, what's in Bob's box changes from being this indefinite, weird kind of state into something that's definite, and it's definitely tails. Okay. So simultaneously, definiteness emerges. Okay, even though these are separated by a vast distance, okay, instantaneously. Okay, this is the kind of influence that something over here can have on something over there that Rob Speckens was talking about last time when he talked about quantum teleportation and that kind of stuff. Okay, so there is something, there's some influence of some kind happening at some kind of at superluminal speeds, but it's not possible to use that influence to transmit information faster than the speed of light. You actually can't send information faster than the speed of light using that.
Is it determined after you open the box?
It's determined when you actually do a measurement on this. When you take that electron and put it through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus.
Okay.
So by opening the box, I'm meaning she's putting it through a Stern-Gerlach. She's looking at it, trying to determine what state it's in, and then forces nature to choose one or the other. Okay, and then when Bob looks now in his box, well, obviously he's going to find tail because it's in a definite state, and yeah, there it is, tail. Okay, or the other possibility. Okay, so we start in this situation here, and then nature chooses between this and this, and maybe nature chooses this option. Okay, and that within that option, so instantaneously, both on Mars and on Venus. This becomes definitely tail, and this becomes definitely a head. Okay, so then when Bob looks, he sees his head. Okay, so this kind of way, this kind of influence, this kind of superluminal influence, is obviously creating a tension with special relativity, with the idea that there's a speed limit in the universe. Okay, and so Einstein had a lot of difficulty with this, and as you know, Einstein referred to this as this spooky action at a distance, and was not comfortable with this. And the point is, that paper, there's a paper called the EPR paper, back in the 1930s, where Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen together looked at this kind of situation in great detail, and really pointed a finger at it and said, this is profoundly weird. Okay? And then over the next decades, by the 1960s or 70s, or 60s, I think, John Bell came along and reformulated that in a very, very precise way and said, this is precisely what's weird about it, okay? And came up with experiments like what Rob Speckens talked about, 75% chance of winning, whereas in the real world, photons can win 85% of the time. Okay, let's do an experiment and see whether indeed photons can win 85% of the time. And then you do the experiment, which was very hard to do, and the technology wasn't developed until the 1980s. And then the experiment was actually done, and yeah, it is 85. So there is something weird like this going on. Okay? Depending upon your interpretation of quantum mechanics, it might appear this way or that way, but that weirdness pops out somewhere. If you try to push it down over here, it pops out over there. Push it down over there, it pops out over there. It's always there. We can't get rid of it. Yeah.
You'll be considering that Alice is opening her box before the ball. I mean, before Bob opens the box.
Right.
What happens if Alice and Bob open the box at the same time?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So basically what you want to do is you want to talk about all of this in the language of special relativity, where you can really see exactly relativity of simultaneity and all that stuff happening. But at the end of the day, it still is similar to this. Okay, that there still is a situation in which you start with indefinite state in both, and then there's this sort of superluminal change to definiteness in both.
So if you have some other person say C in between, who's seeing both Alice and Bob at two ends, and then according to C, that Alice and Bob, both of them are opening the box at the same time. Then
right. Okay. So then, let's see. So what would happen if it's exactly the same time? Let's say this is like a split second before this one, according to C in between. Or let's say it's about exactly the same time. Okay, so then what would happen is basically just nature is going to, again, just choose between that and that, totally randomly.
Still at the same time is going to be chosen.
Yeah. 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 Okay, yeah.
If they can't open the box at exactly the same point of time, I mean, there will always be a slightly different.
Well, okay, but at the same time, if you're in relativity, is a relative concept. So for someone, if these two are at rest with respect to each other, and we have a third person in the middle who's at rest with respect to both of those, then this that the person in the middle can send a light signal out to both. And then, as soon as they receive the light signal, they open the box and they look inside. Then you would say, yeah, according to those three observers, that really was done at the same time. And then you could say, well, okay, but what if the observer in the middle? See, the thing is this: it's a bit problematic because the person in the middle, if the person in the middle is at rest with respect to those two, then yeah, they open at the same time. But if that person is moving, then they don't. Then this one opens at first, and then that one. If they're moving to the left. If they're moving to the right, then it's the other way around. That one opened it first, then that one. So who opened the box first depends upon the observer. Okay, and the whole idea combining this whole idea of entanglement over distances with special relativity is something that is a growing research area. So people are looking at that, and they're saying, they're asking more complicated questions. They're saying, well, what happens if Alice is at rest over here and Bob is accelerating? Okay? Does the entanglement degrade? How does the entanglement depend upon the acceleration? And all kinds of questions like that. All in the context of quantum mechanics in special relativity. So it's a really, really fascinating area, which also leads to, you know, what happens if you have this entangled pair of photons and or particles, and one falls into a black hole and the other one comes out. What can you do with that? So you might have heard, how many know about the information loss paradox with the black holes? So the idea roughly is that, if the black hole like sucks all this stuff, if I take Encyclopedia Britannica, or the Wikipedia database and throw it into a black hole, right? I've like lost information from the universe, right? Will that information come back out again? Okay, and the idea is this is an unresolved problem, but here's an example of the kind of things that people think about. Ooh, okay. One example is, so did you guys hear about Hawking radiation?
Yes.
Someone who talked about that? Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Michael talked about that. Yeah, that's right. I was sleeping. Of course. So I just walked right into that one, didn't I? Okay. So as Michael was explaining so eloquently yesterday about Hawking radiation. Photons come out. So the black hole glows like a hot glowing coal. Okay, and so it's emitting thermal photons. And these thermal photons, in a sense, they're just random, right? It's like a hot glowing coal. These photons are coming off just at random times, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so you might say, well, okay. So I throw the Wikipedia database inside the black hole. And so information has disappeared. But what has happened is the mass of the black hole has gone up because there's some matter that's got thrown in there. Okay, that mass, that increase in mass, is eventually going to be radiated as Hawking radiation. It'll take a long time, but it'll eventually be radiated. And so, you know, one might wonder, is it possible that that somehow the information contained in that Wikipedia database is somehow encoded in those thermal photons coming off? Okay, the answer appears to, like at first sight, appears to be, well, no. Okay, but then if you look at it carefully, and people thinking about, you know, entanglement, this, that, and the other thing, they think like this. They think, what if you had detectors around the black hole, okay, in all directions, and you detected all photons, and you looked for correlations between the spins of the photons. Say this photon hits here, and this photon hits here, correlations and so on, and patterns and so on and so forth. And you wait for a time, basically from now until the entire black hole evaporates. Okay, and you capture all those photons, and you look at this tons and tons of information coming out. Is there a way in that information, in those correlations, that you can recover the information in that Wikipedia database? Will you have recovered the information as opposed to being lost? Right. So. And there are some ways that have been proposed to recover that information involving particle pairs, entangled particle pairs, one falling in and one going out. The details are really complicated, and we have only 6 minutes. Who is first?
So if the black hole constantly keeps sucking in mass, how can it evaporate into the Hawking radiation if it's just one particle at a time?
Well, let's just suppose that we start with a black hole of some size, 5, and then it eats something. Its mass is now 6, and then we suppose that it doesn't eat anything more for the rest of time. And so it'll just so its mass will go like this. It'll jump up like this, and then it'll radiate down.
No, I mean like real black holes in the universe. They suck up stars, but they evaporate due to Hawking radiation.
Right. The Hawking radiation that comes out of an astrophysical-sized black hole, or larger, is extremely tiny. First of all, it's extremely low temperature. So we're saying a hot glowing coal, but really we're talking about a temperature that's typically colder than the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's still above absolute zero, but colder than that. What is the temperature of a typical astrophysical black hole?
Normally, the wavelength is 1/4 the circumference of the event horizon. Right?
Okay.
Not a lot of temperature there.
Yeah, so we could. That's right. So the photons are very, very long in wavelength. So they're so very, very cool.
But if black hole size of a star,
right?
Size of asteroid, size of this. How can it evaporate due to hot?
What's doing both?
Yeah.
So that's just a process of it can absorb stuff.
Sure.
So if that's the case, if it keeps absorbing more than it emits, it will just keep growing, and then the absorption process is just dominates and just keeps growing. I mean, both are happening at the same time: the absorption and the Hawking radiation, the evaporation. But just one is bigger than the other.
Just remember, if it doesn't eat anything else, the time it takes it to evaporate is 10^66 times the cumulative mass of the black hole in terms of
solar mass. I was awake for that. I saw that one.
Oh, too long time.
So the time is that in terms of solar mass.
And it's m cubed, actually.
M cubed, right. Right, so a solar mass black hole is going to take a tremendous amount of time to evaporate. Yeah. Okay, so, spooky action at a distance. So let me just sort of close with, we'll just take 10 minutes here. Okay, and we will look at, quantum teleportation here. So we've talked a little bit about entanglement, what that means, and now we're going to see how can you apply that in the real world in something useful. Okay, so we're going to apply this to something called quantum teleportation. Okay, and it's going to be a love story. There will be characters here. What are their names? Alice and Bob. Okay, so here we go. So our first character here is Alice, and so and that cat. Okay, so Alice lives alone with her cat, and her cat came from. See, it turns out that she knows this guy Schrodinger down the street, and she'd heard these screams of anguish from the cat in Schrodinger's palace, and she realized that Schrodinger was abusing the cat in some horrible way. So she went over there and thought this was totally inhumane, and so now the cat lives at Schrodinger. And I think it's maybe a slightly psychologically damaged cat, but she's very good to the cat, and the cat has been much better since her time with Schrodinger. Okay. Now it turns out that our character Alice here, she's a theoretical physicist. That means that she works at Perimeter Institute here. She sits around on couches and chats with her colleagues. Okay. And she's also an experimental physicist. This is a rare combination. Okay. Now, I realize there's a bit of a problem with this image here. So one is, it's not even the same species, okay? And the second thing is that this looks a lot more like a chemistry experiment than a physics experiment. But I typed in science or experimental physics, and this is what came up. Okay, so there you go. You got to live with that. Okay. So Alice is this rare breed where she's extremely gifted both at theoretical physics and experimental physics. All right? And Alice lives here on the Earth. Perimeter Institute is on the Earth here. Okay? And as I said, she lives alone. But she's met somebody. Okay? And this somebody, he lives on Mars. Okay? So this is a little bit far in the future here. And Bob is some scientist guy over there, and she wants to, and she's met this guy through interplanetary dating service. Okay. Now, the thing about an interplanetary dating service, or any kind of dating service, anything where you're just over the computer link over here, is you're never quite sure, right? Because Bob, claims that he is like A, like super smart, B, like super athletic, like C, like super good looking, et cetera, right? And but when she actually goes and meets him, she might find out that who's just like a dork, right? Whereas, in fact, he has like presented himself as some like super cool, super smart, et cetera, like musician and everything, and poet and like the works, right? Okay, so anyway, so she's really enamored with this guy, and she wants to get up there and meet with him. Her options are, she can either like climb in this like tin can called a spaceship and like float out there, like take 6 months to get there. She doesn't want that. Okay, that she's too anxious for that. She wants to get out there. So she wants to get there much more quickly. But being this like brilliant theoretical physicist as well as experimental physicist, she's going to construct this device called a quantum teleportation device, which is going to get her there a lot faster. Okay, and she's going to construct it in at the basement of Perimeter Institute. Okay, so you guys never took the tour of the basement. Okay, there's lots of experiments going on down there. Okay. So anyway, she wants to get there quickly and like hang out with Bob, etc. Okay, so we got to look at this quantum teleportation. How is this possible? Or is this possible? Okay, so first of all, what do we mean by teleportation? Okay, so the basic picture is we've got Alice, you know, located somewhere. So the idea is she is here now, okay, and then she's teleported, she disappears here, and she, you know, reappears somewhere else later. Okay? So one of the key ideas in this is that it doesn't happen instantaneously. You'll notice that there was a little bit of a delay in there. So we know that whatever quantum teleportation is, whatever this teleportation Alice getting to Mars is, it's not going to be able to get Alice there faster than the speed of light. It's not going to be able to get her there instantly, because that's going to violate special relativity. So, first thing is, there's going to be a time delay, less than the speed of light. Okay, so we imagine, you know, maybe something like this. What would that process of teleportation look like? Well, let's see. We start with Alice here on the Earth, and then what we do is we disassemble her into individual atoms. Okay, so just, you know, pick her apart starting at the head and go all the way down. But each time we like pick her apart, we make sure that we note exactly what state that atom was in. Okay, so it's like taking a puzzle apart but making a note of, you know, how everything was put together. Okay, so we disassemble her into individual atoms, and we beam those atoms, those physical atoms, across, you know, empty space over to Mars. And then we maybe, you know, reassemble her like this giant jigsaw puzzle. Okay, so we take all those instructions and we put those atoms back together again. You know, Humpty Dumpty back together again. So, do you think that's a good idea? Do you think that's going to work? Do you like that idea?
No.
Do you think Alice would like it? Okay. So it turns out that this process that we've just described here is a little bit more complicated than necessary. It turns out that in our real universe, we were able to do something a little bit slicker than this. Okay, and that's the result of quantum fact number one. Okay, so it turns out that all atoms of the same type are truly identical. Okay, so if I have two hydrogen atoms like this, and they're, say, both in the ground state, and I put them behind my back, and I switch them around or don't switch them around or whatever, and pull them back out, there is no way, in principle, that with any technology now or ever in the future, you would be able to distinguish between those two atoms. Okay? So that we know. We actually know that through experiments. Okay? So they are truly identical. So we don't have to actually send the atoms. All we have to do is send the information. Okay? So all we do is we figure out how all those atoms are put together, just send the information over to Mars, and then reassemble Alice using atoms available on Mars. Okay? Are you okay with that? Yeah. That's a good point. That's right. Okay, that's a very good point. So, turns out, isn't there this problem? Well, we end up with two copies of Alice. Okay? So, according to our present procedure here, what we've got is Alice here on the Earth. We measure the information. and there's a reassembling there's a reassembling machine on Mars. And this reassembling machine, before the information arrives, all it contains is the same number of atoms as in Alice. Alice has like 5 million hydrogen atoms, 5 million carbon, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just a heap of atoms here in some random state. And so, what we want to do is take some kind of a measurement, measure that information of how all those atoms are arranged, all the states they're in, et cetera, and then beam only the information. We're not beaming the atoms over, we're just beaming the information. The big long stream of zeros and ones. And then we have this magical machine which puts together all those atoms in the right way, and we get, a copy of Alice. Okay? So we would get two identical copies of Alice. Okay, does anyone see a problem with this? What's the problem? We should kill one. I didn't say that. One of your colleagues said that. Okay. So, let's see. Well, yeah, but that is the problem, right? Because Alice over here, the one that stays back on her, she's the one that was, she's the one that was lonely in her house. She's the one who wanted to meet Bob, have good times and stuff. And all of a sudden, it's not her that's having the good times. It's this one who's having the good times, right? So this is problematic, right, in the extreme, right? Okay, so, yeah.
So what is the consciousness of human beings depends on quantum states? So what we are like trying to extract information and send them there, probably random two people with different consciousness.
Okay. So it turns out, luckily for us, that we don't have to face this problem. It turns out that it is impossible, this is quantum fact number two, that it's impossible to create two quantum identical copies of something. It's something called the no cloning theorem. Okay, so this was proved in the last, decade or so. And so it turns out that it's not possible if you have a system like this in some quantum state, involving superposition and entanglement, some very, very delicate quantum state, it's impossible to make an identical copy of that system, okay, without destroying the original. Okay, so whatever quantum teleportation is, if we want to create a truly quantum identical copy of Alice, it has to somehow destroy the original. Okay, so we won't be faced with this problem. Yep.
When you say destroy, it doesn't actually destroy it, though, like the stuff's still left, so maybe the process would just maybe like give her cancer or something, which you might still be alive.
It would scramble her to the point where she's really badly scrambled. Okay, so she ain't anything like Alice. Okay, so we got it. Whatever the process is, we'll end up messing up the information of these atoms so much that there's no correlation with the original Alice. Okay, right. So there can be only one Alice. Okay. So the original Alice is destroyed. We are teleporting. We are not making a copy. Okay. So let's see. What else? Okay. So the real question here is, how do we measure the information? Right. So the assumption here is that here's Alice standing over here, and somehow we can measure all of that information. Okay. And then send that information over, and then use it to reconstruct Alice using atoms on Mars. But how do we measure the information in the first place? Pass her through a giant Stern Gerlach machine. Yes. That's right. Okay, so the thing about the giant Stern Gerlach machine is that in measuring that information, we actually can't extract all of the information. Okay, if we have so there are a couple of reasons for this. So the problem here is we can't actually do that. We can't actually measure all the quantum information. So we have the Heisenberg uncertainty limits. So for example, suppose that we have particles involving position and momentum, but we know that we can measure the position, but then we totally mess up the momentum, or vice versa. Okay, so we can't have that information. Another thing is certain quantum information, such as entanglement and so on, you can't even measure it. With a single measurement and only one copy of the system, you can't measure it and determine that information.
Couldn't we just get most of the information and kind of fit in something that wouldn't kill her to fit in the rest of the
information? That's right. So supposing we were like super advanced, then yeah, sure, we could make some mistakes and she would come out basically the same. Okay, so, but just sticking with the story, we are imagining that we want to create a quantum identical Alice. Yeah.
So one thing, actually, a common being does not depend on this quantum state, like to be alive or to be a human being. So what about, no matter how quantum information you destroy or whatsoever, you change it, then that does not really change her identity as a human being. Then it will not validate any of the quantum facts or like quantum expressions.
Okay, so I'm not sure I followed that exactly. So you're saying that even if we destroy some of that quantum information or change the quantum state, it'll still be Alice.
No, that's possible because we do not know for sure that actually a human being is a human being because there is some...
That's right. So we don't know whether a human being is a human being because of quantum processes or whether it's just classical stuff going on. For example, your mind. If your mind is only associated with the atoms in your brain, the neurons and all that stuff, maybe it's possible that it's really just classical. You know? Or maybe it is truly quantum in nature. Okay, so these are great questions. Okay, so I don't know. That's for you guys to figure out. Okay, so you guys are the next generation of scientists. Figure this out. Okay, so here's the thing. So basically, if we can't even measure the information we want to send, then doesn't it mean that we can't do this? The whole idea fails. A shortcut through space-time? So if we had a wormhole, we could get her there, say, really quickly. So the idea is, ultimately the idea is to get her there quickly, right? And so one way to do that is, suppose their nature was kind enough to provide a little wormhole for us, you know, one portal of it which was close to the Earth. In fact, in Alice's, I don't know, her basement. She just needs to go into the basement. In fact, there is one in the basement of Perimeter. And so I didn't want to actually reveal that, but you can go down there, and you can control the location of the other portal. And so you can put that one on Mars. No, okay, so we're just trying to find a way to get her there. So that's one way to get her there quickly. And we're just trying to find another way with quantum teleportation.
Well, what about the experiments we did with the moon?
Yeah.
The crystals and the teleporting and that stuff.
No. No. Okay. So, turns out that in 1993, Charles Bennett and some of his collaborators discovered that you could actually send the information from A to B without measuring it, without actually looking at it. It's sort of like closing your eyes, and information is sent from there to there, quantum information is sent from there to there, without anyone knowing what that is. Okay, and it relies on this process. This is the entanglement process. It relies on quantum entanglement. Okay, so let's see how that works. Okay, so it turns out the quantum teleportation is possible using this entanglement. Okay, so I should just warn you here that this is just like at this stage science fiction. Okay, so mature audience only. All right. So here's how it goes. So we've got Alice here on the Earth. And she's in her like home, you know, position. They're ready to go over to Mars there, okay? And she's in this lab on the Earth, and let's see. There's another lab on Mars. These are very fancy labs, let me assure you, okay? And inside these two labs, we have matter. Okay, so there's matter here and there's matter here. Okay, and basically the same number of atoms, say the same number of hydrogen atoms on both sides, et cetera, and these atoms are entangled with each other, okay, in the same way that we've been talking about, this kind of, they're sharing this entanglement property. So they are, you can't describe what is here in Alice's lab without also reference to what is inside the lab on Mars. You can't describe the system all by itself. They are entangled, okay, it's in some way a whole system. A single system, although the two parts are widely separated. They share this weird quantum entanglement. Oh, yeah, the cat needs to be in here too. But, well, okay, she's going to get the cat on the second run. Okay, so, all right, so here's how we do it. This is how the process works. So there's a machine here which is going to do, which is going to store information here. Okay, and we're going to make some kind of a measurement. Now, the measurement that we make is not just on Alice. It turns out that, so previously we had in mind, you know, like quantum, like teleportation on Star Trek or whatever, there's this, you know, and people go like this and they fade out, right? So it's kind of like that, except it involves both Alice and this matter, this yellow matter that she's standing next to. Okay, so it's a measurement, it's a joint measurement of Alice and this matter. Okay, so we do this joint measurement, and out comes information, classical information. Okay, and this classical information is stored on a hard drive. Yeah, something happened over here. Okay, so and what happened over there is completely analogous to what we were talking about with the heads and the tails inside the box. Okay, so with the heads and the tails inside the box, we had initially we had this indefinite state of reality in Alice's box, and an indefinite state of reality in Bob's box. And then when Alice made a measurement here, what she did is she forced this into a definite state. She enforced, in fact, out of all options here, she forced nature to choose one. And what she did over here in forcing nature to choose a definite state instantly forced this to be a definite state as well. Okay? If it was heads here, then it became tails here, that kind of thing. Okay, so the thing about this measurement, so let me just run that measurement again. Okay, we're almost done here. We just run that measurement again. So we start out with this, with these atoms entangled with these atoms in some like crazy state or whatever. We do the measurement and look on the right-hand side what's happening. So what's happening is this is changing from an indefinite state to something definite. Okay, but it's not quite Alice. Okay? In fact, there's a huge range of possibilities what could be in that box. What's in that box is definite, is a definite state. But it could be anything with basically the same number of atoms. Okay, it could be like a tree, could be like a cow, could be like, you know, anything, right? Could be a hat, could be like a desk, could be anything with the same number of atoms. Okay, so that's a bit problematic because, you know, Bob is coming over to visit, right? And she doesn't want, like, Bob, because she's been saying, yeah, like, I'm really, like, smart, et cetera, et cetera. She doesn't want, like, Bob opening the door and there's this, you know, I don't know, like a rabbit or something in there, you know? Like, it's, like, not good, right? So she needs to get back to herself, okay? And so the way she does that is this information is very important, okay? If this information gets, if we have a hard drive crash, that whatever's in that box is in trouble. We got to get this classical information over to Mars, okay? Now you'll notice that what has happened so far has happened through this mysterious quantum entanglement. There's a great deal of quantum information has been transferred from here to here. Okay, but it's not enough. We need to also transfer this classical information. And the only way we can get that to Mars is less than the speed of light. That's where the speed limit comes in the quantum teleportation. Okay, so we send this information over to Mars using just ordinary radio waves or whatever, less than the speed of light. That information arrives on a hard drive on Mars. Okay, and you'll notice that over here, what's left on the Earth is something where all of the original atoms of Alice and all the original atoms in that yellow block of matter have been entangled together. So the entanglement has shifted from the yellow block and the yellow block here. The measurement has shifted the entanglement from that pair of matter over to that pair of atoms, that pair of matter. Yeah, so that's right. It's like that. So yeah, if you have another one here, this is like Alice in a definite state, say heads, and then you share this entangled pair. You make a measurement on this pair together, and in the process, it takes information from here and transfers it over to here. This becomes a definite state, but these become entangled. Okay, it makes sense. Okay, we don't have time to go through the details. Oh, okay, but I have a great handout here which explains all these details, okay? So you can look at it later. So let's just finish the story. We need one more minute here. So here we've got all this information over here, and somehow we need to use this information to fix Alice up, okay? And so this information is fed into this magical machine which has all kinds of dials, et cetera, et cetera, and she then runs through this machine over here, and it produces a quantum identical copy of Alice on Mars, okay? And the fact is, this kind of process has been done, okay? Not with an Alice, but with first of all with photons, and then with electrons, and the state of an atom has been quantum teleported in this way. The point is that you are not teleporting matter. Okay, what you're doing is you're taking some matter over here and some matter over here, and you are teleporting the quantum information. You are teleporting the state the quantum state of this matter onto the quantum state of this matter and making it identical to what it was over here. And that's effectively equivalent to having picked the thing up and moved over there. Okay? Yeah. States of atoms. Okay, so that's that. So I think it's time for dinner. Okay. So you got a 10